Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
Hi, how are you, Rob?
I'm good. I'm alive.
Well, so am I.
I know, but I'm feeling like really alive today.
Tell us why.
Because I was in hospital like for ages. Yeah, I was really sick.
I didn't know that.
Yes, you did, you evil witch.
Why was you in hospital, Rob?
I had meningitis.
Oh, God.
But I survived. And the interesting thing is, I've been on the Meningitis Now website, that's the charity, and so many people our age actually have it. Like that really great TV presenter.
Lisa Snowden.
Lisa Snowden had it, and she's an ambassador for it. And actually, our guest today, I think her daughter even had it not that long ago.
Did indeed.
Yep. I love it when our guests start talking
when our guests pipe in.
So, anyway, I'm alive. I'm feeling really happy.
Good. Are you still feral? Are you passing it?
Feral?
Yeah, you passed it on to us.
Feral? That is so mean. Everyone write in and complain. Thank you. So, our guest today is someone that I have known pretty much since I started going to the galleries, maybe when I was like 22, 23, early 2000s. And she's someone that always made me feel very, very welcome. And it was at a time when I was a bit nervous. I used to turn up at like Maureen Paley or White Cube or all these shows, The Approach, galleries like that, and in London. And I would always be a bit nervous because I felt like everyone was a bit cooler than me. And I still hadn't made friends yet. And Louisa was somebody that I would often bump into. And she was always so friendly, so enthusiastic. And had a similar kind of joy about art that I myself have. And I get a bit carried away sometimes and can be very like, I love you to artists. But I feel like Louisa also has that kind of energy.
Yes. Well, I feel exactly the same. I mean, when I first met Louisa, she just felt very, made me feel very included and very inclusive.
Yeah.
And she's always been present and she's always been a part of it. And it's been incredibly exciting to have her kind of hand-holding throughout our journey through the art world. And when we first met, we're actually here now with our books called Owning Art, which was our little Bible. Which
I know. Kind of we used to talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
And even the design of the book I really loved because it was this kind of like linen cover, grey cover. It was very like classily designed.
It's beautiful.
I really liked
it. It's just basically a Bible of like how to get into the art world, how to own and collect art, why people collect art with quotes from artists and galleries and critics and other collectors. And it's just a phenomenal book that we kind of lent on a lot.
And the thing was, as well, like when you're first getting into the art world, we didn't really know if you could ask questions or you know, it was all a bit mysterious.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
I felt like the book
gave you... don't want to look stupid. It's a book that...
a lot of answers.
It isn't elitist.
Exactly.
I think our guest is not elitist and very welcoming to anybody and really wants people to own art and collect art and be part of this world and enjoy art and not in a level where you need to be hyper... theoretical about everything that you're seeing. She's very eager to talk. she's a regular contributor to the art newspaper with her blog called The Buck Stopped Here. And she's also a critic for The Telegraph.
And is often seen on BBC TV.
Yes.
And was even a judge of the Turner Prize in 2005.
2005, when Simon Starling won. And we're going to ask her about that. But we're very, very, very honoured and very excited to invite and introduce Louisa Buck.
Louisa Buck, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm sitting here wiping away my tears after all that. That's lovely. No, I think you're right, though. The art world is such a sort of butter-clenchingly status-anxious place that, you know, you kind of forget, or people often do forget, that it's the art that matters, you know.
Yeah.
Never mind about the parties and whether you're sitting next to so-and-so or invited to whatever.
Yes.
It's the art and the artists as what makes us love it so much.
Do you come across like young collectors like us a lot? Have you seen people over the years that have been quite green and then
it's changed so much. You know, when I first came into the art world, when, you know, dinosaurs roamed the earth.
With the cave paintings.
There's nice Neolithic cave paintings. No, but, you know, just a little bit after that, in the kind of early 80s, it was very different. It was a tiny, you know, progressive art was a tiny, tiny world. It crossed over with club life. We had the neo-naturists. We had Grayson Perry. We had, you know, young artists in squats. Then there was this Listen Gallery lot, all being kind of, you know, Anish Kapoor-ish, and but they were relatively young then too.
Got it.
And that was kind of it. There was a couple of galleries on Cork Street. Maureen Paley out east, pretty much the only one.
Wow.
And, you know, it was tiny. So there weren't collectors as such. People bought art, people bartered for art. The prices weren't that high.
Yes.
It was a really different scene.
Do you think it was more based on true passion for what it was like? You know, like, it's like, and they say artists have to make art. That's what they have to do. And if that time feels to me, nostalgia-wise, like that is the situation. Whereas now, maybe because it's a commodity, inverted commas, that it doesn't feel like it has that drive as much. Like, if people were struggling as much now as they seem to be then, would they still be making the art that they would be making now?
I think it's so difficult to tell because, I mean, I came in just pre-YBA.
Mm.
So yeah, it was very old bloke in suit,
yeah.
Cork Street. Artists waited to be discovered with a sort of, you know, finger pointing from the sky, you know, with a pinstripe sleeve. it was really very elitist, very male, very snobby, you know, and then you had this whole kind of explosion of the YBAs. I mean, of course, it's become a brand name. Of course, they don't, you know, they're MABA, middle-aged British artists it really was very different. That there were obviously people who've been doing stuff in artist-run spaces before. Of course, people have broken through and been young. There had been young gallerists. There'd been trendy gallerists. Look at Robert Fraser or, you know, John Dumba with Indica Gallery that gave Yoko Ono her first show. There was going on before. But this whole idea that actually, if you were a young artist, you just went out and you bloody well did it for yourself. You weren't going to wait for some bloke in a suit to kind
of... Who was the bloke in the suit? Who was anointing people?
It was Anthony Doffey, Leslie Waddington, Nicholas Logsdale.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, you did have Maureen Paley, or Maureen O'Paley as she was then.
Really?
With
her buzz cut haircut. You know, I mean, a whole different, no Buffon then.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a whole different kind. It was a very different one. That's what I'm trying to say. So young collectors, young people, if they had money, bought trendy furniture.
Got it.
Or sort of some kind of Bang & Olufsen speaker for their stereo.
Sure.
Art, they'd have some horrible framed poster on the wall. You know, there wasn't the art market there. You didn't have art fairs. You had the odd weird art fair in Earl's Court. I remember, you know, the neo-naturists and Grayson Perry having a stand on James Birch's in this Earl's Court art fair and looking so weird and sticking out like a sore thumb. It was kind of magnificent. But, you know, it wasn't this art market like it is now.
So this is pre-Tate Modern. This is pre-Charles Saatchi
space. We're talking early 80s. We're talking 84, 85.
Where did you come from?
I mean, I came from Essex girl, me. Yeah.
Whereabouts?
Colchester.
Oh, right. Well, you know, I'm Bromford, Billericay, or my family's out in Biltown.
Billericay Dicky.
Yeah, exactly. That's me.
You know, maybe not.
That is
me. That is me, but...
Back of the Four Cortina. No, I mean, I was Colchester there, and then I went to school in London, and then I went to college at Cambridge and Courtauld Institute. So I had a kind of academic training.
Right, right.
But I very quickly realised I wasn't going to be an artist.
Your mum was an artist, wasn't she?
No, my mum just went to art school for a bit.
Right, right, right.
She's kind of housewife, basically. Never really did much. But... loved art, though.
How did you access that in Colchester?
Well, I think, you know, I met, there was a guy called James Birch who ran a gallery in the New King's Road and still does a bit of dealing now, but who's, you know, a bit older than me.
Right.
And he was around in my kind of group a bit in Essex, but very kind of exotic because he lived in London as well.
Right.
And when I came to London, when I finished at Cambridge, went to the Courtauld, came to London, he was running a small gallery in the King's Road. He was showing British Surrealism, he was showing Grayson Perry, the Binney Sisters, all kinds of very eclectic mix of people, Luciana Martinez, God rest her, who was Andrew Logan's sort of secretary in Alternative Miss World, her paintings.
It
was a very kind of bohemian world, and I thought, yes, this is what I want. I want to be around people making art. I wasn't in the sort of art school world. It was more the academic world, stepping into this friend of mine who ran a gallery that interconnected. Lee Bowery was there, Rachel Auburn was there. It was the whole kind of club life overlapping with art making, and that was my kind of entry point, really.
Wow.
And then I started working at the Tate and also working for City Limits, which is the lefty version of Time Out.
Yeah, I remember City Limits.
And I did the arts for them for a bit, and I was
as a critic.
Right. Yeah, desperately hoping they wouldn't realise that my dad was a dodgy Tory MP for Colchester and Essex.
Did they find out?
They never did. Okay. No internet. No internet in those days.
Pre-internet.
So, you know, it was a funny old rickety existence. And you could be rickety in those days because people could, you know, squat. People could live on the dole.
It was a bit hand-to-mouth.
It was much more hand-to-mouth and much more possible. I mean, now, you know, everyone has to have a 400 jobs. You're bedecked with debt if you go to art school. The art market has exploded. Mm. If you run a gallery now, you've immediately got to do art fairs. You've got to have this kind of footfall. It's a whole different thing because the world has changed.
You've got to watch the auction houses.
Yeah, but I'm not going to get too misty-eyed because I think also it was very patriarchal. It was very elitist. Artists didn't make much money. I mean, the explosion of the art market, everybody kind of, you know, gnashes their teeth about a bit as though it's all gone so commercial and so superficial and all this. But it's meant that many more people could make a living as an artist.
Make money, yeah.
Many more people like you two come in to collect art. It became a trendy thing to do. Mm-hmm. I think Frieze Art Fair was incredibly important, but before then I think Tate Modern was absolutely crucial
Then
Charles Saatchi Gallery and Boundary Road was crucial so it's been this kind of incremental progression but I mean I do think, you know, the role of Nick Sirota, the role of Damien Hirst, the role of Charles Saatchi, the role of the young gallerists like Jay Jopling, Sadie Coles, it was a kind of critical mass thing that came together.
Well, it's defined the art scene, hasn't it? Do you think it did internationally as well? Do you think they had a massive effect on, like, American art?
Well, ironically, what happened was actually a lot of this art that was happening in Britain in the 90s got taken much more seriously overseas than it did at home. I remember Ingvild Gertz in Munich collecting it and showing
amazing
that.
Collection.
Amazing collection. Yeah. And also more serious people as well, you know, who are not so easily, not more serious necessarily, but more less easily accessible film and video work, stuff that Charles Saatchi didn't like, she did like.
Yeah. Right.
Apart from Charles Saatchi, there wasn't an awful lot of exposure happening here beyond the commercial gallery network. Mm. But then you had also gallerists in New York showing Mary Boone showing work, and also again the British Council were really important. They had a couple of shows early on in Venice and also around the world of young British artists before they were called YBAs.
But of their own collection, British.
Well, no, or putting on shows in Italy and across with Gillian Waring.
There was an amazing Michael Gillian Waring, Tracy Emin. Oh, I can't remember who else. There was a few artists who all went to Japan with the British Council.
Yeah, and there was the very maligned, brilliant show in oh God, my brain's gone. Minneapolis, I think it was.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Walker Art Centre.
Yes.
Which, okay, was a bit corny because they put blown up buildings on the front of the IRA, blown up buildings on the front of the catalogue, and they had beefeaters, apparently, people dressed up at the private view. It was all a bit like, oof. But it was, nonetheless, a big explosion there. So I think, you know, back at home, apart from Charles Saatchi and some commercial galleries, institutionally, things lagged behind. Not because I think the Tate were particularly anti, but because just it didn't work like that. Everything had to go through committees, and it was all very kind of glacial slowness. So I think, I mean, Tate Modern comes in 2000, then more big galleries come to town, London becomes a big contemporary commercial art hub, and then Frieze happens. So I'm kind of waffling on, but, you know, it was a very kind of interesting ferment, and I was lucky enough to be kind of lurking around during all that and seeing that different world.
Something you mentioned about the patriarchy, and a lot of the names you mentioned there are all male, you know, even Charles Saatchi, all of this. And then when I was thinking about when I first met you last night, I actually started making a list of everybody in the art world that had inspired me or been welcoming to me when I joined the art world. And literally, I wrote like 35 names and they're all women. And what I find so interesting now, and I read this amazing article from 2006 where Alice Rawthorne interviewed all the gallerists who were in London and female. And she was wondering... She said that compared to other industries, the art world had actually become, by 2006, a place that women were able to be very successful in a way that they couldn't in other industries, particularly as a gallerist. And even though there's a big, inequality between prices of male artists and women artists in the marketplace, often women artists... works will sell for less at auction, things like that. But they were saying that galleries, you could actually be a leader. And there were many examples, you know, like Sadie Coles, Maureen Paley, Victoria Miro,
Marion Goodman.
There's literally so many.
Yes.
And actually all the people that I felt welcomed by were curators, and they were all leading, like Margot Heller, you know, Jenny Lomax, Polly Staple. It just goes on and on. And then these days, even people that inspire me now, like Vanessa Carlos, they're all women.
Yeah.
And why do you think that is? And did you find in art criticism the same thing, or was it more male-led art criticism?
Well, I mean, apart from Sarah Kent, And I mean, I'm talking about the UK here, obviously, yeah, many great art critics, you know, across and in America especially.
Yes.
But I think America was always ahead of the game in that particular.
You do think
In terms of writing and writers, right, okay. And academics and feminism. And I mean, there were many great feminists here, don't get me wrong. I mean, yeah. but I think you know, the critic thing, the newspaper thing, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, that it was still very blokey, apart from Sarah and me. Now it's much more of a mixed field in the mainstream journalist world. I would still say, though, it's only very recently that you've got, you know, Maria Balshaw, Frances Morris at the very top of the institutional directorial tree.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was always men. And still, if you look across the world at the great institutions, the great museums, it's still very male dominated. But yes, you're absolutely right. There are many, many female galleries, and actually were also Ileana Sonnabend, you know, very sort of, pioneering women. And I mean, I think perhaps it's because it's a tricky one. I mean, I think it becomes like a sort of family, the gallery thing too. And I think there's a sort of matriarchy within that. And I think, on the other hand, the art world is very unsympathetic towards people having children. And I do think it's very, I mean, I've got three.
Still.
And it's really hard. Well, it's just logistically really hard, you know. Mm. It's a punishing old, I think any big business is, and the art world has become a huge business. But, you know, one thinks
about. But you have to be present, don't you?
You have to be present. Yep. And also, I think being an artist, it's really difficult to be an artist as a mother with kids, particularly if you've got more than one. I mean, Phyllida Barlow brought up her kids and then became, you know, then went into the market.
Yeah.
I mean, she's always an artist. She taught, you know, she was very much practicing making her work. But, you know, I think
that seems to be a trend, isn't it, with female artists as well, that they kind of, I read an article the other day about saying that female artists stagnate at a certain age and then they're rediscovered. And you look at people like Rose Wiley, and you mentioned Phyllida Barlow, that later on in life, if they have children, then they have to wait until they get their.
Well, you know, their husbands. I mean, I think in the case of Phyllida, it was a mutual thing. But you know, certainly with Rose, you know, she stepped back, and her husband
Roy,
who's a wonderful artist, was the practicing when he did the writing and the teaching and all this. I mean, I think, you know, there's a case by case basis, but I think overall, yes, of course, the art world is very much now, you know, a large female presence is within it, and women operating within it.
Mm.
I think if you drill down a bit deeper, I think, I don't want to go into the whole sort of child thing too much, but I think it is a tricky one if you've got a family.
Right.
And I think also you need to look as well, you're right, Rob, about the auction prices. Yes, I mean, give or take a few, male artists still make immeasurably more, but also look at the represented gallery of the artists by the commercial galleries, and actually it's very unusual. I think Sadie and a few of them are exceptions, that there is even parity with women artists,
right?
Male, female. So, you know, there's an odd thing. Many more women than men graduate from art school, but then many more men than women actually become represented artists within the art market.
Right.
And that's an interesting phenomenon, I think, because it's still a very difficult sphere to enter into, I think.
How did you balance it then?
Blood, sweat, tears, and au pairs. Primark.
That's the title of your autobiography, is it? Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was tricky because I was also a single mum for 16 years. So I pretty much brought them up on my own. And yeah, I mean, it was very, very demanding. But actually, I was very lucky that I don't want to go into my personal life, but the ex was never a huge, let's say, a huge wage earner anyway, at the best of times. You know, I mean, my kind of single mother life coincided over the last 16 years, 17 years or so, with the art market expanding.
Got it.
So I could actually make a living. I mean, I was doing all right beforehand, but, you know, sort of I could actually up my game and make a living because the art market expanded. So the art newspaper, we're doing the daily papers at the art fairs. Art fairs, I mean, you know, you two are too young to remember, but I remember when art fairs were these grubby little trade-only affairs that dealers would go in little clusters and sort of, you know, barter a few works and buy and sell, and a few big collectors would go to Basel. But, you know, no self-respect, living, contemporary, radical artist wanted to be on an art fair booth. I mean, heaven forbid.
Really?
And now, of course, they're gnashing their teeth if they're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's interesting. But anyway, the long and short was that I was able to make a living. I could go to the daily papers. People wanted to employ me. You know, magazines, newspapers were suddenly really interested in contemporary art. It entered the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
People like you started getting really interested in it. People from other walks of life, the theatre, music biz, whatever. You know, it became something that people wanted to be part of in a way that just wasn't the case before.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it possible for me. But now, I mean, it's been really difficult because obviously, you know, you can be traveling all the time.
Sure.
That's hard. You know, you're juggling stuff. I mean, but find me any woman that doesn't, and indeed many men too, but, you know, it is a juggly thing. And maybe without sounding too naff, that's also why women are really good gallerists, because you do have to, you know, consider all sorts of different things at the same time. You've got to, you know, manage your artists' careers. You've got to make sure they're okay. You've got to be a mentor, a supporter, emotionally, creatively, fiscally. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of juggling.
Would you take your kids along with you to things?
Oh, hell yes.
And are they interested now?
Oh,
they,
yeah, yeah, completely. I mean, my daughter works for the Freelance Foundation, which is an art foundation.
Right.
My youngest is doing art A-level, and my bigger one certainly always loved art. I mean, you've got to be careful not to overkill. I'd never take him to the Venice Biennale opening. That would be tantamount to child abuse. You know? but, you know, also it's fun, you know.
Yeah,
and
of course it is.
The great thing about the art world and why we're all sitting here is that, you know, it's a bit like joining a cult. You kind of get immersed in it. And your social life, your personal life, everything, you know, you don't necessarily have to have sort of, you know, partners who are in the art world, but, you know, many of my friends are in the art world. Many of my friends are artists. And of course it's tricky when you're reviewing shows. And I think Adrian Searle,
a friend,
the wonderful Guardian art critic, said no conflict, no interest. You know, I mean, there is you're all constantly redrawing your lines in the sand because it's a very complex, interconnected world. Yeah. It's also unregulated.
I was going to say that, so, you know, because that's one of the things that in the article I think Maureen said was that she thinks because it's the last unregulated industry in a way, and it hasn't been set up in some ways these days by men, like it's just, it's kind of, you can do whatever you want, there's no rules in a sense, and therefore whereas other industries have often have histories of being set up in a certain way by patriarchal, you know, system or whatever.
Do you mean critically?
I found that quite interesting. Well, just the art world is just unregulated.
Well, I mean it's unregulated. Yeah, no, Rob means absolutely literally. Stuff goes on in the art world that would be completely illegal anywhere else. You know, market building, insider
the trading,
the fact that, you know, everything, even when an artist is, you know, brings in millions of pounds to a gallery, it's on a handshake. There are very few legal binding contracts, which means, of course, an artist can walk.
Yeah.
I mean, this happens a lot in the art world, that you know, a gallery, a smaller gallery, will find an artist at art school, bring them on, support them, and then, you know, just as they're on the cusp of really making it big in the art scene, you know, a larger gallery will just come along and pluck them away. And off they'll go to, you know, a much, much larger mega gallery.
Is that changing then? Can you see a change in that? Because that has been...
That has been the case, but the trend recently,
isn't it?
What's interesting is that does happen, and then, of course, you know, because... But then it can be tricky also, with a gallery that's a smaller gallery, either you get the fact that one larger, more prominent artist might be, you know, getting all the attention that the other artists also need, or reciprocally, you get the fact that the larger artist is actually bankrolling the enterprise and feeling resentful about that. On the other hand, you're right, though, that Russell, there is a slight change in that some artists actually now want to have a bit of both. They want perhaps the high-end mega gallery managing their career,
and
they want to be in a smaller space, like, say, Vanessa Carlos, the wonderful founder of Condo, fantastic gallerist, who, you know, has some fantastic artists who are also doing big stuff elsewhere, but they like the sense of being able to be with their peers, you know, show with a gallery that's very sympathetic to their ethos, that shows other artists, their contemporaries that they respect. So, you know, I think it's a very mixed ecosystem.
And it is important, I think, if you're like a 30-year-old artist or a 35-year-old artist and you suddenly become massively successful, to then suddenly sort of leave all your peers and would just be so insane. I mean, it would be like, I just think it's the wrong thing to do, because then...
Well, there's all ambition, isn't it? I guess it comes down to how ambitious you are and where you want to project yourself. And I feel like it's been tried and tested. So a lot of artists have seen that happen, and then it's sort of, they've crashed and burned, or they've gone out of favour because they've boomed too high too quick, and then people aren't interested anymore. And what's nice about staying with the boutiques is that through them, if they're inclusive and they like their friends and the other people on the roster, is that people... collectors or gallerists or whoever go to see the art of their work, and then they by proxy see everyone else's artwork on the roster, which is an amazing thing, and that
which
gives them other artists exposure.
You've discovered loads of artists
through like really loving one artist and then going into that gallery space and then suddenly seeing, oh cool, who's this person, and the best artists I've met are the ones who are like, oh, if you like this, then you should meet this person. They're my favourite artists. Do you know what I mean? That are supporting their friends.
Yeah. And I think the art, overall, the art world runs on relationships.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it really does. And it runs on conversations. It runs on relationships. It isn't regulated. So it means that people, I mean, there is a bad thing. As I said, you know, artists can walk off and leave a gallerist just sort of going, God, I spent 20 years supporting this person. They've gone. Or on the other hand, you know, an artist can have a fallow period. And, you know, if they're with a gallery that is not so sympathetic, they might get the heave Devo as well. I mean, it's and there's no real protection there. But by and large, the fluidity, I think, is why we all love it. Mm. It is based on relationships. It is based on artists recommending other artists. A really good gallery. Galleries that have lasted a long time, like the Listen Gallery, like Maureen, like Sadie Coles, is because the gallerists will listen to their artists. Yes. And artists will recommend other artists. Yeah. Artists will bring other artists in. Mm. And a really good gallery will actually be collegiate with other galleries also. And that's happening more and more, particularly when it gets tighter and tighter. Yeah. I think particularly in that very middle bit of the sandwich, you know, you've got the high-end, you know, corporate kind of guys who are like almost global franchises and they just roll along in like a multi, sort of, you know, huge, huge industry. Then you've got the very small artist-run spaces, but you've got a big wedge in the middle of galleries who are, you know, really struggling. And actually they do become collegiate and their artists are collegiate because we're all human beings. We're all social. You know, it was sweet what you said to begin with about me, but I just feel like anybody who loves art, it's a broad church. There's room for all of us. Let's not get all proprietorial and protective. It's like writers, you know, the more art writers there are, the better. Yeah. You don't want someone actually nicking your job, obviously, but you know, you want to recommend people and spread the love, basically, because, you know, we'd all be making much more money doing something else, probably. Mm. We do it because we love it.
Mm-mm-mm. Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser Beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser has also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
So something that you did in 2005, you were a judge on the Turner Prize. Mm-hmm. And the Turner Prize to me has always been this very it was something that I used to sort of look to, you know, when I was learning about art, to sort of see, it's almost like a kind of gold star or something, isn't it? And each year you have four artists, and often the shows used to be at the Tate, didn't they?
Yeah.
But these days they actually travel, and I think this September it'll be in Margate, where our new gallery is. Very exciting. Fantastic. But the year you did it, you had one of my all-time favourite artists, who's Jillian Carnegie.
Well, yes.
I love her paintings
Me too.
So much.
Me too, absolutely.
I think she's incredible.
And
who else did you have? You had Simon Starling,
who
actually
won. Simon Starling won it. It was Darren Armand, Jillian Carnegie, Jim Lambie.
Yeah, it was those four.
That four.
Yeah, great four.
That's why my memory seems so long ago now. And it was kind of a different time a bit. I mean, the Turner Prize, you only get asked to judge it once. It's like one of those things.
Oh, do you? I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, well, maybe they'll start rotating us around again. But so far, and it is kind of a blessing and a curse. But obviously, it's nice to get asked and you feel like, you know, woohoo, thank you very much. But actually, I turned it down a couple of times before then because I really hated the fact that until it was either my year or the year before, The winner got it all. Nobody got anything else at all. Whereas now there's a chunk of money, not very much, a few thousand pounds, that each of them gets to put the show on. Because actually it's a big gig. You know, suddenly telling an artist with very short notice that they've got to put on this kind of, you know, big career-defining show at Tate. Of course they say it's a sample show. And of course, you know, on the rules of the Tate, on the rules of the Turner Prize, it's awarded on the strength of a show that the artist had anywhere over the last 12 months. But of course they've got to do a good show at the Tate. Or Tate, or wherever it is. It's been in Hull, it's been in Northern Ireland, it's been
a lot of the time. It's the work that had come from that defining show that they got nominated for that gets put in there, right?
Well, kind of, but they've also, quite a lot of the time, you know, A, it may not be possible, and B, they want to make a good show because artists don't really want to just regurgitate their old stuff. They want to do something new and something, you know, something that's going to be good, or at least something that's going to make a good show. And of course, then you've got the other problem where you've got these four artists who are chosen by a jury, a highly subjective jury. I mean, without giving away too many state secrets, but I will anyway, who cares? It was so long ago. I mean, I was a huge fan of Jillian Carnegie, and actually, once I got her on the shortlist, I mean, I really respected and admired the other artists as well, and I was very happy that they were there.
Yeah.
And I was happy with the shortlist. Actually, who won it, as far as I was concerned, was neither here nor there, really. It was more getting a good shortlist that I felt proud of, each of them.
Yeah.
And Darren had done this amazing show, The Auschwitz Bus Stops, which was that extraordinary show of getting the real bus stops from Auschwitz and installing them. And his work is so much about time and journey and memory, and it was just the most. I mean, sadly, didn't put those in the final show at Tate for the Turner Prize. But anyway, that was that. Jim Lambie was doing those amazing, you know, the floors and
love
all this incredible assembled work. And also the work with the belts and paint and wall hangs. So that was really good. Simon Starling's always been a really interesting artist about that sort of wonderful, extraordinary journey to get the artwork at the end. And often it sort of goes through many different incarnations, both physically and conceptually. And then there was Gillian, who's just the most wonderful painter. And I'd just seen these extraordinary paintings at the Cabinet Gallery. And
were they the bums?
They're bums and also monochromes, big dark monochromes of wood forest that you could barely see except when the light caught them, and you could see all these different textured brushstrokes.
That's so incredible.
And that amazing the work that she goes back to again and again and again of a bunch of dead flowers, basically, in a chopped off mineral water bottle. I mean, like, how, you know, low rent is that? Rotting away, drying away in her studio space that she's painted repeatedly in different styles. And that all sounds a bit kind of meh when you're talking about it, because that's the thing about art, you've got to see it.
Yeah.
But she really is extraordinary. And the other jurors didn't really know her work very well and hadn't really seen, but sort of felt they should have done.
Yeah.
So I really did storm a bit of a barn to get her. And they all agreed it was great that she got on the shortlist. And I was so happy. I would like to have won it, but sadly that wasn't quite happening.
Me too, actually. But actually, I mean, they're all good.
Exactly. Yeah. So I didn't really mind once that happened. But the way it all works, I mean, now I think the Turner Prize has become one prize amongst many. It's there's new contemporaries, there's Hugo Boss, there's many more shows, there's many more, there's a John Moores Prize. It's just, I don't know, it just all seems to be more sort of fluid. It's not such a massive big deal.
Right.
It doesn't get so much media coverage. But in the old days, anyway, I went rambling off, but I didn't want to do it a couple of times before because they didn't get a chunk of money, which was actually a really big deal, because if you're represented by a big gallery, then you can immediately have a lovely show at Tate and it's all fine. But if you don't, if you're not, if you maybe don't have any representation at all, or, you know, your gallerist is overseas, you're a bit like a lamb to the slaughter at the Turner Prize.
It's not a level playing field.
It's too exposing, isn't it?
Exposing, you're not getting the support. And also, in my day, it was still sponsored by Channel 4. So, you know, all these artists would have to be I mean, Tate were a bit naive about it. They didn't realise that
they
Channel 4...
needs to be media trained.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Channel 4 needed Tate as much as Tate needed Channel 4. Yeah, but Channel, yeah, Tate was, I think, so kind of overwhelmingly grateful at Channel 4 for giving them all this profile that the artists were kind of slightly flung in,
yeah, yeah,
to doing, or having camera crews in their studios. And you know how, well, you of all people, Russell, know how intrusive, you know, telly is and cameras and all that. And I mean, you know, if you're an artist, that's not part of your gig. It may be, but it may well not be.
I found quite interesting, actually, doing this podcast, is that there's certain artists that I thought would have just come on straight away. And they actually say they hardly do any audio or video interviews. Like, there's two or three who I didn't even realise they've never really done any. They only do, you know, like magazine articles, which I find so fascinating these days. I love that, though, about them. I was like, that's so cool. But you can actually not do a video or audio interview.
But also, you know, back in my day, I mean, artists didn't really, you know, it wasn't part of the remit. You didn't have to, if you were successful as an artist, I mean, I'm doing parenthesis here, because successful, I mean, kind of profile-wise, because obviously there's many different forms of artistic success. But you know, if you became a relatively high-profile person, I mean, someone like Grayson Perry or Tracy Emin, you know, loved it, were really good at it, that was it. But someone like Rachel White-Reed, perhaps, who isn't, you know, I mean, she's a fantastic artist, but, you know, her idea of a good laugh is not sitting here chatting about her art, you know, she
and actually, if you think
friends,
about,
you know,
if you think about like Gillian Waring or artists like that, I mean, I think they actually all make their work as a way of communicating with the world.
Yeah.
So their way of them talking is their work.
Absolutely.
Therefore, they don't need to talk about their work. Do you know what I mean? Like, their work speaks for themselves.
And that's why it's one of the favourite things that I do, actually, is to interview artists. And I think it's such a privileged part of my
job
to be able to go and talk to artists. And, you know, I've just done a great interview with Georgie Hopton, who's got a show coming up. I did a show with Linda, L-I-N D-E-R, wonderful, wonderful Linda.
Modern Art Gallery.
You know, I mean, very different artists, wonderful artists. You know, I've interviewed so many in my time, and, you know, it's such a privilege and a treat to be able to.
And that's actually why I love being a gallerist. Like, I went from music to being a gallerist simply because I loved being around artists.
All right,
and I love
a bit of gossip.
Supporting thing. Yeah, so.
Who's your favourite? Who's been the best? Who's been the worst?
What do you mean, interviewer?
Yeah, interviewee.
Oh, definitely the worst was Julian Schnabel.
Really?
Oh, why?
God, just so rude. I mean,
really?
Beyond rude. We didn't meet. It was on the telephone.
Right.
He was obviously on the telephone. It was those days when you had a sort of, you know, fistful of blackberries, you know. So he was obviously kind of talking to about three different people at the same time. It was actually about a show that he had. Oh, God, I can't remember what it was now. It was in some Mayfair gallery who had a show of his work.
The plates, was it?
It was the X-ray plates. But also it was around the time of the Diving Bell and Butterfly that he directed, which was a brilliant film.
Yeah.
You know, and I was and I thought, my God, he may be a total twat, but, you know, boy, can he direct a movie?
Yeah.
And actually, the Basquiat film he did was okay.
Yeah, it was okay.
You know,
agree.
And anyway, so that was that. So, but he was so rude. I mean, so, you know, either accept to do the bloody interview or don't, you know. But don't then just give one word answers. And, you know, I'd really quite care. I always over swat my interviews and quite carefully planned it. And it was on the phone, which is not as easy as being face to face. But sometimes, weirdly, it's better being on the phone because it sort of focuses. You're in the zone, you're not having social life, you're not sort of fretting about your tape recorder or your whatever and sort of looking for the cup of tea or whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyway, with him, it was an absolute disaster. He was rude. He was really quite, you know, obviously didn't want to do it. What kind of question is that? I didn't really hear you properly. Well, can you repeat that? And I was like, yeah, sure. Blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, I can't remember now, it was years ago, but it was just a really unpleasant experience. You know, I just thought, oh, God, what a nightmare. I've also, and I won't name names here, but I had a couple of artists who've been absolutely pissed when I've interviewed them. So
really?
I've got rambling.
So not like really elusive,
nice. I mean, right. Delightful and charming, but not making any sense. But I will tell you about one of the worst interviews I ever did, which is so funny. It taught me such a great lesson. It was a great interview, but it was a great encounter, but a terrible interview. It was with Leo Castelli, the late, great, legendary gallerist.
God,
you know, I mean, the king of, he launched pop art.
Yeah.
You know, Rational Machines. There he was, this legendary figure. It was early on. I did it for the second edition of Freeze, so you can, you know, see how long ago that was. And off I was in New York anyway, and I met him, and he was absolutely charming. I mean, he was in his 80s by then, but beyond late 70s, beyond charming, immaculate, dapper, obviously adored women. Took me out for, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, whatever. He took me out for lunch and we chatted and he was just delightful. I had my tape recorder going and we talked and it was just lovely. And I went away just glowing with kind of excitement and joy and happiness. Listen to the tape, listen to the interview. And He just asked me about myself. He just, every time I talked to him, every time I tried to ask him about himself, he just very elegantly and beautifully kind of slid it off somewhere else, or really didn't answer any question at all. But it'd been so charming that I'd been completely bedazzled.
Spellbound.
Completely spellbound. Completely charmed. Thank God there'd been a rather good Kelvin Tompkins New York Times profile. I did a bit of plundering from there and a bit of plundering from that. And I did actually kind of have a little chat with him on the telephone as well. But it was such a good lesson
to me. That's almost like who he was.
Exactly.
So in a way, like, the psychology behind it is
so Brits,
that he's completely amazing at making you feel good.
I got enough from it. But, you know, it just made me laugh. I thought, oh my God, this is such a good lesson that, you know, you are not there to make friends.
Yeah.
Right.
You are not there. Because I just want everyone to love me and kind of hug everybody
and all that.
And he made me feel completely loved, adored. He was I felt so interesting.
So funny.
And I mean, it was just, you know, the interview was okay. The profile was fine. It was okay. But, you know, I learned a very good lesson then. Just, you know, you ask the questions. And also, shut up. As you can tell, I do love to talk.
No.
You, really?
Let them speak. So many interviews I've done where there's been, you know, the artist talking about to say something really interesting and I chime in with some hilarious thought of my own or sycophantic laughter or it's like, shut up, Buck. Let them talk.
So funny. You've just reminded me that I was in Venice years ago during the Biennale with Maureen Paley and we were walking through St. Mark's Square and we bumped into Norman Rosenthal. I'm just going to name drop now. This is a very silly
story. Norman. Storm
and
Norman.
So, and he just curated a show for Julian Schnabel and it was in that amazing like palazzo thing off the main St. Mark's Square.
Yeah, yeah.
So Maureen was like, oh, I haven't seen the show yet. When's it opening? And he was like, oh, tomorrow. Why don't you just come in now? We go in. Julian's there, like looking at the installation with Leonardo DiCaprio, his girlfriend at the time, who was some actress, I've forgotten her name. Blake Lively.
Oh, right.
She was off Gossip Girl or something. Yeah. And then Naomi Campbell and Naomi Campbell's Russian boyfriend. And we were just stood there. And I was like, what am I doing here?
Stella Street.
And then, no, but he just arrived and he was showing his friends around the show. So we walked around the whole show with him doing long speeches about each painting with Naomi Campbell and Leonardo DiCaprio. It's from the weirdest moments.
What was he saying? Anything interesting?
I don't think that.
You can't remember, you see.
Yeah.
Isn't that telling?
Yeah. But Maureen and I were just kept looking at each other thinking, like, why are we here? We'd literally gone for lunch or something.
Oh, but the art world is so fun. Venice,
so weird.
Venice does. You do have some weird stuff in Venice. I remember once, in the old days in Venice, everybody now goes to the, what's the hotel? They all go to
The Dan, is it?
Or no, it's not the Danielli. No, there's one, the hotel buyer.
Oh, yeah, hotel buyer.
Everyone ends up on the terrace at the buyer now. So wherever you've been, you end up on the terrace at the buyer. In the old days, it was Hague's Bar, which was in a sort of behind the Gritti Palace, but it was a big square, basically, with a little tiny bar, and everyone filled up the square and chat, and so everybody ended up there. So wherever you'd been, you know, you always ended up there, which is quite good for the status anxious and the FOMO, because you always knew everybody would end up there anyway. Yeah. Anyway, I was dying for a pee, as usual, and there was a long queue, and in the end, I get to the toilet, one toilet, this enormous crowd of people, and I'm shaking the door and shaking the door, and come on, because it was hours this person was there, and I open the door, and out comes Chaka Khan.
No!
And I did go, ooh, Chaka Khan. She didn't look very amused. I think there'd been some big gala for Derek Jarman, and she'd been there with Liz Taylor, and they'd been there. Whatever. And I just thought, you know,
she
only in Venice
do you rattle
a toilet door and out comes Chaka Khan.
Brilliant. Chaka played live a few years ago in Miami about four times. I kept every event I went to, she was singing at
the White Cube.
Yeah,
party,
bars on Miami. White Cube had her, and then she was somewhere else. She's brilliant. Love her.
But that is the kind of bonkers thing that's, you know, the Biennale is kind of calmed down now, but it did get to a stage where everyone was talking more about whether you got Kraftwerk playing at the German party or you know, Jarvis Cocker or Fatboy Slim doing the Brit party or, you know, it was just like, oh, come on, guys. Actually, there is a bit of art knocking on here as well.
Yeah. So when it comes to art, do you have your favourite discipline of art? Are you more drawn to painting or...?
God, it is so difficult, you know. I mean, I'm a real omnivore. I mean, you said that you're going to ask me some specific stuff about what my favourite X, Y, or Z was, and it really depends on the time of day, what I'm feeling, what I'm seeing. I mean, you know, I love a good painting. I love a good drawing. I love a great sculpture. I love a great installation. Good. You know, I adore Martin Creed, but I also like maximal crazy work. And I would say that Martin Creed is actually very maximal in a minimal kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some of Steve McQueen's films have just moved me beyond anything else, as are some of Tacitus Deane's. But, you know, it's very difficult for me because I kind of... It's whether it's good of its kind and whether it's doing what it should do within the medium that the artist has chosen.
Yes.
I can't say. Right across the board, I love it all.
And do you collect?
I mean, I don't. I I own art.
Yes.
I have bought art.
Yes.
I have commissioned art. But yes, the art world has changed. I have, you know, freelance journalism. You don't have much disposable income, particularly, you know, single mum, three kids. But yes, I've bought lots of art in my time. Not so much now. I've commissioned art. I mean, when I was...
You wrote a book on it.
Yeah. But that's... Yeah. And then, of course, I mean, there's quite a funny story about that, actually, because I Grayson Perry is an old friend from way before he became Mr. Famous Successful artist. And when I was pregnant with my now 27-year-old, I said to Grayson, who was then a mate, not remotely known in the art world, and I said, make me something, you know, because I'm going to have this baby. It's just so extraordinary that I'm going to become a mother. Wow. Here's a couple of hundred quid. Make me a plate or a mug or something. He made me this enormous pot with me giving birth all over it. I mean, very niche market if ever I wanted, which I don't resell it. And I still have this treasured, wonderful, great big pot with me giving birth. Very
and you live with it? That's
oh, yeah. It's in my bathroom on a shelf. And then I've got, he made me another great plate called The Face of a Man is My Rightful Throne, which is extremely rude, as you can imagine. No, I've got quite a few. So, but that was back in the day, you know. I mean, now it's very difficult because I'm quite old and all that, you know, I've known people a long time and, you know, you can't say, here's a couple of hundred quid, make me something, when their market price is an international telephone number was worth of zeros.
Got it.
So, you know, you've got to be careful about all that. Yeah. And I don't, but, you know, I'll buy works on paper.
Yeah, I do.
I'm always doing Allied Editions at Frieze is one of my faves.
Yes,
or if there's
yes.
a, you know, I mean, like, I bought a beautiful Camille Henrot work on paper from the Chisenhill editions. So, you know.
And Studio Voltaire, I've got
Studio Voltaire,
editions.
I adore.
So many. And Whitechapel. I mean,
I bought Monster Chetwynd, then Marvin Gaye, Chetwynd from Voltaire.
Yeah.
So I'll do that because it's hundreds of pounds or, you know, but even that I can't really afford super much and I don't buy it for investment or anything. I mean,
but they're supporting as well, aren't they, of the institutions
when you buy
this work from
them. And I mean, also, you know, if it's an artist that you really love, I mean, I've been lucky artists have given me work as well, which is, you know, good for birthday presents or whatever, which is incredibly nice and lovely. But, you know, it's tricky because you then don't want to be selling stuff because that's just weird and then also it undermines everything. I mean, it is complicated, but I think, I mean, in the owning art, the sober little grey fabric covered book, linen covered book, you know, the mantra is don't buy art to make money.
Yes.
You know, I mean, yes, you can make a huge amount of money. And nowadays, of course, there's always someone with deep pockets or somebody who will flog something to somebody or the auctions, you know, the baton goes up. But bottom line, you're not loved in the art world. And you know this, Rob, from, you know, working and being a gallerist.
Yep.
But, you know people who've, I mean, everybody who's got a good collection will know how their holdings and art are appreciating or whatever. Of course they do. And a lot of these people came out of business in the first place. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're not doing it predominantly for that reason. And I think that is so crucial.
And actually, there's an amazing quote in the book from Barbara Gladstone. Weirdly, her quotes in your book are like the ones that really resonate with me, probably I'm a gallerist, but she's so eloquent.
She's so smart.
So smart. But one of them just said, like, art is not a stock and should not be treated as such. And part of the problem is that people begin to talk about it like a stock. Nobody has a crystal ball and nobody can read the future. However, I would say that if a collector is really serious, does his homework, follows things in the right way, and actively looks at the history of an artist and a gallery, the chances are that they're not going to lose money. But to buy art with an eye to making money, that's a completely different thing. And it's something that I just, in the core of me, it like repels me, the idea that you would buy art to make money.
Yeah.
And I find that so problematic. And it's not even just being a gallerist. I feel it just as a human being. Like, I just don't think art, you know, but equally I'm selling art. So it's kind of a strange
equation. But if you're an artist and you're making work, you know, I think it would be so dispiriting. I know it is because I've talked to artists about it. If their work is being bought as an investment, you know, and it never sees the light of day, it sits in some bonded warehouse somewhere and never gets seen until it gets shunted off somewhere else.
And it's almost reducing the kind of soul of it. You know, it's like minimising everything about an artwork. It's the worst, really.
You know, it's the artist putting their view of the world out into the world. You know, I mean, of course, artists have, you know, been made commissioned work for millennia and all that. And that's another thing as well. But, you know, it's an instrument of communication, exactly that, and a touchstone for humanity. You know, we will be remembered by our artworks, by, you know, how many zeros we had in our bank account or whatever. And it's something that's so intrinsic to our civilization. So if you're kind of just using it as stock, it's just so depressing.
And actually, while I was ill over the holidays, I ended up watching a lot of films, obviously. And one of the ones I watched was that George Clooney film about the American army who went in to save all the artworks from Hitler.
Oh, yes.
What's it called? Something Men.
The records, what's it, Man? Oh, God.
Yeah, there's something Men anyway.
Exactly that.
And it was such an interesting idea that he was trying to take all the culture Hitler was, you know, away from everyone. And then he wanted to have his own museum or something. It was so insane, the that looting. Story.
But it's always, yeah. been, it's always been the case with authoritarian regimes that they want to control culture because culture is the expression of who we are and what we are.
Exactly,
so, you know, I find it so odd with, in Russia where, you know, the constructivists were the instrument of revolution. It was this democratic geometric forms that would then translate into manufacture. It would be, you know, there for everybody. And then, of course, Stalin says, no, it's all elitist and bourgeois to have these abstract forms. We want, you know, great big ladies holding sheaves of corn and men with tractors. You know, it's a kind of, it's this mode of communication is really interesting, I think. Definitely.
Totally, yeah. The Monuments Men, that's the name
Monuments
of the film.
Men, thank you. Yeah, so I'm Monday morning and my brain's not working.
But I found that really fascinating, that story.
No, but preserving it, exactly that. And the fact that these works were all in underground, you know, underground caverns and vaults and mines and barns. Yeah. And then they were looted. And then, of course, people were busily trying to stuff their Rembrandt into their rucksack. And, you know, when they were plundering stuff. And the fact that, you know, these guys realised how important culture was and how you can't just, treat it like
the other thing I found out the other day, sorry I'm going a bit off tangent here, is 9/11, how much art was lost in 9/11. I had no idea. It was like some crazy figure of art that was lost because of all the corporate collections and everything.
Yeah, no, I didn't realise that actually, but I guess once I was thinking about the
human
cost.
No, I know, you think about the human cost, I know, exactly.
I mean, you know, having said that, I'm not in any way wishing to belittle these terrible cataclysmic events, but, you know, culture gets lost, culture gets found, culture gets made. It's part of the kind of weft and warp of our existence.
Yes.
So going back right to the beginning of our conversations, when you were talking about, you know, the art world when I entered it, I mean, our society has changed. You know, we've got the internet. I mean, I'm pre-internet, for God's sake.
Well,
I'm
pre-mobile phone. Book was pre-digital.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm very happy that book. I hope it's a bit like the sort of Mrs. Beaton's cookbook of
no,
collecting
but I love
art.
It.
It is a sort of funny little classic thing, because it was very much about not what to buy, but how to buy.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, the world is so changed, you know, and becomes global, you know, interconnected. But, you know, we are all human beings and art is a human enterprise. And that's why I think, of course, artists use the internet. Of course, everybody now goes online and checks out websites and
hashtags.
Instagrams and hashtags, everything.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, nothing, I would say, maybe I just sound like an old dinosaur, beats the encounter with an artwork directly, face to face. Even if it's artwork on a screen, you still experience it in the right kind of setting in which the artist wanted it to be seen, you know, rather than actually on your laptop or on your phone.
Yeah. So the last two questions before we tie this wonderful interview up are regular questions we ask all our guests. One is, what is your favourite colour?
That is so difficult because it changes according to the day.
But it's so good.
Today I'm wearing a flame red scarf and it's a freezing cold day.
It's
so that is my favourite colour. But if I was if it was the middle of the summer, I'd be loving that ultramarine blue of the Greek sea. So can I say both red and blue, please?
Yes, you can.
And the other question, Russ, do you want to do that one?
The other question is, what is your art plunder? What would you try and steal if you could steal any painting and get away with it?
In an art heist?
Well, it would be quite a big art heist because it would be Velázquez Las Meninas in the Prado.
Great.
I would roll that up and take that away.
That's an easy one to get out.
Well, I know, easy peasy, you know, major epoch-changing artwork because it's everything. It's abstract, it's figurative, it's psychology, it's drama, it's a time capsule. It's just brilliantly executed and it's perpetually enigmatic and wonderful and so modern while being so kind of timeless.
Is that a touchstone for you whenever you go there?
Oh yeah, always.
Yeah,
always.
Wow.
I just stand there and kind of just, it's just the most, one of the most remarkable things ever made, I think.
Wow.
The two things in my, I think that museum, the Prado, is pretty much my favourite
museum
in the world.
The Goya black paintings there, of course, that absolutely knock out as well.
Totally.
And the Hieronymus Bosch.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's a good one-stop shop.
Oh, it's such a great museum.
But, you know, there's something about that particular painting that is just so endlessly fascinating to me.
Got it.
Wow.
And are you writing any more books?
At the moment, I'm kind of on hold. I've got various ideas and plots, but the thing about writing books is, you know, I have a living to make and it's very difficult because it is... It's a huge enterprise.
So
I'm doing the old journalism at the moment, and doing a lot with that, and also a lot of radio and a lot of TV. So that's kind of using up my time. But I'm sure there'll be some more books in the pipeline.
Well, Louisa Buck, thank you so much for
you
coming on Talk Art.
Oh,
we could just literally do a whole series with you because it's just fascinating.
But
actually, we just interviewed Martin Creed, so check that episode out.
And we're just
out.
About
brilliant.
To have Julian Schnabel on.
Oh yes, my best.
Before we tell you, send your love.
Rip his dressing gown off.
Oh, and here he is, Julian.
Everybody listening to this, please check out Owning Art. It's the Contemporary Art Collector's Handbook by Louisa Buck and Judith Greer, and it's published by Owning Art. And there's also a number of other books that Louisa's done, which you'll also find.
I did one on commissioning art as well, published by Thames and Hudson, which is another kind of handbook jobby as well. She says butting in at the end.
You did one for Tate, didn't you? What was that one?
Yeah, that was called Moving Targets, a User's Guide to British Art Now, but it really was British Art Then, because it was last published in 2000. So it's, you know, the artists are all still there, but it's, they've done quite a lot since.
Got it.
And Commissioning Contemporary Art has a beautiful orange cover. So that's with Thames and Hudson, and you co-wrote it with Daniel McLean, art lawyer.
He's a lawyer, and it's the same designer as Owning Art, so it looks very pretty.
And what's your Instagram?
My Instagram is @loubuck01.
Got it. I looked at your Instagram, and you don't have a link to any...
I know, I've got to be more clued up about all that.
Got it. Right.
And talking of Instagram, please check out @talkart, and you can see images of everything that we've spoken about in today's episode.
Yes, thank you very much.
We will be back very soon.
Yes. Big love, Louisa.
Thank you, Louisa. Thank you. Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram @talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.